Thank you, John. You'll have to apologize. Sometime in here, I might have to blow my nose because Utah has some allergies I've not yet been exposed to. But she should have asked more questions and taken less for granted. She lived the life of a wife of a successful business owner. She drove a luxury car. She dressed very fashionably. She was active in civic and social and charitable affairs. And every Tuesday, she played bridge at the country club. She lived a perfect life until her husband died suddenly at work. And the first time she was ever in his office was the day after he died. And what she found was that this business that had supported her in such grand style was, in fact, a shell held together by duct tape and baling wire. He had left no will, no life insurance, no succession plan, no retirement plan, no estate plan, and no instructions. And what it made it worse were the key employees who were absolutely essential to the very survival of the business were leaving like rats from a ship, sinking ship. And at one time, her CPA told her that she didn't even have enough money to file for bankruptcy. And this is a perfect example of no plan, which is the number one of all the landmines. In preparing for this presentation, I talked to attorneys and CPAs and merger and acquisition and bankers and all sorts of different advisors, and number one on their list was no plan. And you know, it's amazing to me, with all of the information that's available, why business owners have built successful, profitable businesses, have accumulated great wealth, but they've taken no time to plan for the succession of the business. They've given no thought to how to dispose of the business or how important that business is to the community and to the employees that work for it. And it's amazing, again, to me, how many businesses are either liquidated or the owner just walks away. And if you doubt that, all you have to do is to look in your local newspaper and you'll see article after article, you'll see ad after ad where business owners left. So how prevalent is this? Well, according to an article in the Wall Street Journal, it said 44% of business owners have no exit plan, no succession plan. And what's amazing to me is over my 44 years, that number really has never changed. It's always in the 40s. There was another article in Forbes magazine that said 43% of public companies had no CEO succession plan. And 61% had no emergency succession plan. The lack of action in the face of compelling logic to plan was something that frustrated me my whole career until I learned a concept of guided discovery. And guided discovery is one person being led by another to learn from their own experience. It was a way to get your objectives done for their reasons. You see, the only way that you can get a person off of dead center is you've got to be the person that ask the right question. You've got to be the person that asks the compelling question. If you learn nothing else, you want to be the person that asks the interesting question. If you're a gathering like this, or you're at a social event, or that you're at a soccer event, or whatever, you want to be the person that asks the question that they remember long after that event. And so, guided discovery is a process of enrolling, which is to get people to do what you would like them to do for their reasons. Now, another landmine is waiting too late to plan. There's a management adage that's been around for as long as I can remember, and it says the day that you start your succession planning is the day that you open your business. The day you hire your leader, your CEO, is the day that you start your succession planning. But we know from practical experiences that businesses don't do that. That the owners get caught up in the everyday operation of the business. They take all of their money and they throw it back in. We had a perfect example today of the young woman, was her name Kim, that spoke and talked about her husband's world evolved around his business. And so how do you get business owners to plan when we know that their traditional method is not to plan? And what happens is when they wait too long, their options become limited. And the later they wait to plan, the more landmines begin to attach themselves to the planning process. It's like a ship attaching or attracting barnacles, but these are explosive landmines and booby traps that are fatal to the process. Here's an article that's over 20 years old, but it's as true today as when I put it in here. The day the business opens is the day you start your succession planning. I saw the previous owner of this company get to the point where at age 65 he was desperate. He had done nothing to prepare for his retirement. He had no succession plan. He was vulnerable because of his age, and all of his assets were in place, one place. And I thought to myself, I hope I learned something from this. When the business owner waits too long to plan, he can find himself with a limited number of options. The best succession plan is where the previous owner withdraws rather than abruptly leaves. And in many cases, it takes 3 to 5 years to be able to develop a successful succession plan. And at the very least, it takes a year. Here are just a few of the questions that a business owner has to look at when he begins to develop his plan. There are only three choices that you can do with a business. You can sell it, you can retain it for the family, or you can liquidate it. Well, if he's going to sell it, who does he sell it to? Does he sell it to his partners? Does he sell it to his key employees? Does he sell it to competitors? Does he sell it to outsiders? Does he go public? Does he do an ESOP? How's the best way for him to get his money out of the business? Is it going to be an asset sale or a stock sale? Is he willing to finance the purchase? And how can he minimize taxes on the transaction? If he retains it for the family, he's got all of the issues we just discussed, plus who's best qualified to handle the business. It's always a difficult decision to choose which child will be the heir apparent. Does anybody want the business? Can the business support me in my retirement as well as the new owner or my son when he comes in or my daughter? And what do I do for the children that are not active in the business? And then liquidation. What are the economic and tax consequences if I liquidate the business? These are just a handful of the considerations that you have to look at when you begin to develop your transition plan. There was an attorney that I work with, and he told me this story. And it was two business partners that had started a business. And the trap is waiting too long to execute the plan or not executing the plan. And there was an older partner who was the financier. He put the money into the company, and there's a younger partner, and he was the nose. And the business was that they made perfumes. And the nose had the ability to take these complex chemical compounds and make beautiful fragrances with them. And they developed a buy-sell agreement, and they funded it with a $1 million key person policy on the nose. Well, unfortunately, the business went south and the business failed. But now they had a problem. These wonderful, fragrant perfumes now became toxic chemicals. And you can't flush a toxic chemical down the toilet. They had to be burned. And that was a very expensive process to go through, and the business was already failing. And in the midst of all of this, the nose died. And the company paid $1 million. Unfortunately, the nose never signed the buy-sell agreement. And when his family came in and asked the owner for their share of the $1 million proceeds, he said no. And they lost everything. There are all sorts of other landmines that attach themselves to the process. The first three basically are all the same, not having a plan. The first landmine is fairly obvious. All of the other landmines that we're going to discuss are where you become the trusted advisor. If you have an understanding of these landmines and you know how to bring them up and how to phrase the question, you will get all of their business and you'll get all sorts of referrals. So, landmine number four, failure to consider the risk. Risk, or the potential for loss, is a standalone landmine. It's always there, but it attaches itself to all of the others. And I think risk is often overlooked in the heat of the deal. The seller is so eager to sell the business and the buyer is so eager to buy it that they don't look at all of the factors. And what's happening is both the seller and the buyer are mortgaging their financial future on the continued success of the business. That's a great power question when you're dealing with business owners. You're mortgaging your financial future on the management ability of the new owner. Well, what happens if there's a business reversal? The seller certainly doesn't want to come back and take over the business, and the buyer doesn't want to lose their business. So, if a seller has built wealth outside of the business, there's more flexibility, there are more options. Now, we worked with a family, and the father had sold the business to a son. It was a very profitable business. And the father had negotiated a really good golden handcuff for himself. He got a lot of money down on the purchase, and he got a deferred comp and payments over a period of years, which set him up very nicely. But very shortly after the sale of the business lost three of their major customers. And the revenue dropped $100,000 a month. So the dad was in jeopardy of losing his share of the business, his proceeds from the buyout, and his son was in danger of losing everything. The saving grace was the father had wealth built outside of the business, and he was able to support himself to give the son the opportunity to make the money back and to create other things. Here's a big one, is not understanding the value of the business. Unfortunately, most business owners sell businesses. They buy and sell businesses like they buy and sell cars. They have no concept of how to develop the valuation of the business. They may use some multiple of earnings. They may use some multiple of EBITDA. They may use competent appraisal. But they really don't understand how to value the business. I talked to a merger and acquisition advisor that told me that most business owners leave 30 to 40% of the value of the business on the table because they don't understand business value. A client called me, actually it was a friend of mine, and he was the acting CEO of a sushi company. And this company had a technique of keeping sushi fresh. They could keep it in the refrigerator for 6 months and you would swear it had just been prepared. And along with that, they had contracts, distribution contracts with Costco and Safeway and Kroger and a number of other ones. But the company had been mismanaged, and when my friend called me, he said, "We're drowning in debt. We're so much in debt that we can't pay the IRS what we owe them. I need somebody to buy the business for the amount of debt." And I said, "Well, let me bring in a business valuation expert and see what you're really talking about." The valuation expert came in and he said, "The value of this business is $100 million. The guy said, "You've got to be joking. We've got a negative balance sheet. All the numbers are red. And we owe money to the IRS." He said, "The value of the business is not in the financial numbers. The value of the business is in the intellectual property and the distribution contracts that you have. People will buy this business just for the distribution contracts." Now, they didn't get $100 million, but they didn't sell it for a pittance either. And so the value of somebody that understands business valuation is so that you can get the proper price and that you're not going to leave 30 to 40% of the value of the business on the table when you sell it. Now, a lot of business owners will balk at bringing in another advisor and paying the fee. But the difference between losing 30 to 40% of the value of the business and the fee is a small difference to pay that business valuator. So I would encourage you to add a business valuation expert to your team of advisors. The other problem in valuations is ego. People have an inflated ego of the value of their business, and they place too high a value on the emotional portion. And what happens is they refuse to sell, and they refuse to sell, and they refuse to sell, and then if you say no enough times, you stop getting asked. There was an upscale antique gallery in Seattle, and it dealt in treasures from around the world. It had a huge following in the rich.com crowd and the interior decorators for the rich and famous. And the guy was getting older, and he wanted to retire. The story, by the way, was told to me by his son. And so he wanted to sell the business, and he kept getting offers, and they were good offers, but they did not meet his inflated ego. And so exactly the thing happened. He turned them down until there were no more offers. And then the dot-coms crashed, and he lost everything. He lost his business. He lost his investment. He lost his retirement. He came out with nothing, just because his ego got in the way. There's another thing about businesses. Sometimes there's no value because the current owner has either spent the value or he sold the business to the bank through his line of credit. He's maxed out his line of credit. So the only thing a buyer has when he begins to look at the business is to buy the debt. And so there's nothing there, and he just walks away. And what happens is the business owner ends up, again, losing everything. They spend all of their money, and they mortgage it to the bank. It's like a reverse mortgage of a business. And if you want to sell your business for maximum value, you have to manage it a different way. If you want top dollar price for your business, you can't be draining all the money out of it. You've got to keep the money in there. We had an engineer that was referred to me by a bank, and he was an acoustic engineer, and he had a unique talent that allowed him to develop a niche market and a national reputation. And he did business all over the world. And he had a key employee that he promised 25% of the business to when there really wasn't any values. And as he began to get older, and he was looking at retiring in the next 5 years, the business had grown in value, and the key employee said, I want my 25%. Well, the problem was that the business owner had been using the business for his personal checking account. He had spent all of his money, and then he spent all of the company's money, and then he continued to borrow money and spend that money. And we had put together a really good succession plan for him. But his wife began to balk on a succession plan because they realized they would have to come up with $200,000 in taxes to give the key employee 25% of the business. Plus, they would have to take a 25% cut in salary because it was an S-corp, and they didn't have the money. And once the no value came out, the whole deal fell apart, and he lost his business, and he ended up going to work for somebody else. Here's another thing, fair market value versus fair value. Now, if you read most buy-sell agreements, it will say the value of the business is fair market value. And then it will have a series of notes and other agreements. So it'll say either fair market value or competent appraisal. Now, what's the difference between fair market value and fair value? So you and I own a business, and it's valued at $1 million. And so we have a $1 million life insurance policy. You die. Your spouse comes in to me and says, Tom, my husband died. I want his half of the business, $500,000. I said, I plan to honor that. We have a buy-sell agreement. It says that he's entitled to fair market value of his 50% share. Fair market value allows for a lack of marketability discount, a lack of control discount, and a minority discount. So let's say that was 30%. So now instead of paying your widow or your widower $500,000, I'm going to discount it by 30% and pay him $350,000. That's the result of fair market value. So how many times have you looked at that and brought that to the attention of your clients or your prospects? Fair value would have been the $500,000. It's important that you work with advisors that understand the concept of fair market value and fair value and how you apply it. Many business owners establish a buyout methodology which is unsustainable. What happens is they have a business that's overvalued with limited or no growth. And it's a common mistake to overlook whether or not the business can support the purchase price and still pay the buyer a reasonable and fair salary. And buyers sometimes have an unrealistic projection of what's reasonably feasible. We had a client, it was a family-owned business, and the business came from the mother's side. And she had inherited the business from her dad, and she had built it up, and it was a business that was worth about $20 million. And she had four sons. One son was active in the business, and three sons were not active in the business. And the three that were not active in the business had various problems. And the one son who was active in the business wanted, in the worst way, never to be in business with his brothers. And he was willing to pay whatever price it took for him to get the business. And so he bought the business from his mother at absolutely top price. Now, most parents try to give their kid a deal. She did not give him any deal. He paid absolutely top dollar for it. Yet the growth potential for the business was already maxed out. And the price that he paid for, funded out of cash flow, could not stand any downturn in the business. And so he really did mortgage his financial future, not only on his ability to manage the company, but that other factor of risk. It was interesting, though. I asked the mom how she felt about it after the deal was done. The deal was she got $1 million tax-free money for 20 years. And I said, how do you feel about it? And she said, it's fine if you don't mind living on a fixed income. The other thing is that when owners sell their business and buyers buy it, if they don't consider the impact of taxation. If you're buying a business, you have to pay tax on your earnings before you can make the payment on the note. In our case of the acoustic engineer, when he found out that he had to pay the tax on the stock bonus, that's when everything else began to fall apart and unravel. But if you look at a 15 to 30% tax that has to be paid before you can fund the payments, that could sink the whole transaction. Sellers often think of the payout in gross terms and plan their finances accordingly, only to find out that when the money comes in, the actual amount of money that they get is much less than they anticipated. At the same token, the seller doesn't take into consideration how much money they have to make to buy out the company, which is another power question. When you're talking to somebody about a buy-sell agreement or succession planning and you have two partners, and you talk to them about your partner dying and how much money they're going to have to come up to make those payments that's in their buy-sell agreement if it's not funded by life insurance, is you say to them, what you're telling me is that having lost a key member of your management team, you're going to have record earnings for the next 5 years to be able to buy him out and keep the company going. How realistic is that? That's a pretty interesting question to ask. Sometimes we look at terms. A lot of business owners don't look at the terms of the agreement. The term might be 20% down, 20% over the next 5 years, or 10% over the next 10 years at prime plus whatever at a local bank. And what happens is neither party understands the written agreement. Might be an excellent document. Might be put together very well. Might have all the standard provisions. But what happens if you can't make a payment? Like my example of the son who bought the business from his dad and he lost $100,000 a month in revenue. What if I can't make those payments? What's the buy-sell say? In most cases, the buy-sell says, if you can't make the payments, you're in default. Well, the seller doesn't want the business back. He didn't want to have to come back in and run that business. And he doesn't want to lose his money either. And the buyer doesn't want to lose their investment. So what if you had a clause in your buy-sell agreement that said that the payment, the note payments, could not be more than 50% of the revenue of the business? So they could be adjusted in the event of a downturn. Now, if the provision called for a reduction in payment, it probably also would call for a lengthening of the note. So if it was a 5-year note, it might go to a 7-year note or a 10-year note. Provision also may allow, under certain circumstances, that you could skip a payment. But these type of provisions would need to have limitations. But the advantage is that both parties would be protected. The seller wouldn't have to take the business back, and the buyer wouldn't necessarily lose it. What about if I sell you the business and a deal I've been working on for 5 years comes in the year after I sell you the business? Maybe there should be a provision in there that says for the next 5 years, on maybe a decreasing basis, if a landfall profit comes in that was a result of my efforts, that you would still pay me some of that. On the other hand, what happens if the business drops in value? Is there a way that you could adjust that price? So when you look at these buy-sell agreements, what you find in wills and buy-sell agreements is a lot of them are written by formula. They're standard formulas that we have begun to accept. And so the questions are, do you understand how this works? And then when you begin to help them understand how it works, that's where you become more and more valuable to them. Landmine number 7 is you don't plan for the unexpected. I had 3 clients who rushed into buying businesses without doing good due diligence. 2 of them were motivated by panic because they had lost their job and they felt they had to get back in something. The other one was just stupid. The first one bought a business only to discover that when heavy rains came, it flooded the manufacturing floor, ruining his equipment and all of his inventory. And it happened when he was very vulnerable financially, because it happened 6 months after he bought the business. And there was no recourse. Now, if he had had a good due diligence, he probably could have avoided that. The other friend bought a property and casualty agency. He was going to get rich on his property and casualty agency. And right after he signed the agreement, the note was done, the sale was complete, the 3 lead companies of the property and casualty agent had the ability to approve or deny the sale. They denied the sale and withdrew from the agency. He didn't have non-competes with his employees, who quickly left and took all the clients with them. So he lost his primary carriers, he lost his employees, and he lost his customers. What he did retain, though, was the note that he just signed in buying the business. The third individual paid top dollar for a company. And again, more motivated by panic, and the company dealt with commercial contractors. And the whole business relied on how successful those contractors were. Well, then the building boom hit Seattle, and all the contractors, and many of them, went out of business. Had he understood the business valuation process, where he didn't pay too much for it, and he would have had some of these other factors, he wouldn't be in the situation he is today. But he's slowly crawling out of it. All of these could have been avoided if there would have been good due diligence. And that's why you want to deal with competent advisors. That's why you want to be the person that asks the interesting question. You want to be the person that asks a question nobody else is asking. Because then you become the trusted advisor. So that brings us to collaborative teams. Do you have a collaborative team? I have attorneys and CPAs and business valuators and commercial bankers. I even have a car broker. I want to be one of the top three people my clients call for anything. They want to buy a house, they want to buy a car, they want a real estate, whatever. I want them to call me, and I've got a team that I can go to. So we worked on one case. It took us 18 months to get it done. In that, we had five attorneys, three CPAs, two business valuation firms, and numerous bankers. The whole key of a collaborative team is you have to be focused on one thing, which is meeting the needs and the objectives of the clients. And the other thing about collaborative teams is there's no room for ego. Everybody has to play nice. And if you have somebody that doesn't play nice, then you get rid of them. If you're dealing with a client and the client wants to use his attorney or his advisor or whatever, and that advisor won't play nice, you got to tell the client he won't play nice and we can't get this done unless he changes his attitude. Number eight. I get to talking here and I don't keep my slides up to date. This is a huge one. It'd be interesting how many of you have ever considered this. A major landmine that almost always goes undetected is the failure to recognize that there are two transitions in the sale of a business. The first is a change of ownership, and the second is a change of leadership. And the change of leadership is usually manifest by not understanding the culture of the business that you bought. I was telling Brody, I used to work for Allstate. And there was a man that left Allstate and went to CNA as their CEO. Allstate agents are direct agents. You basically were employees of the company. Well, you were employees when they wanted you to be employees, and you were independent contractors when they didn't want you to be employees. But at any rate, it was a closely controlled group. Well, when he went to CNA, those were all independent advisors. And he tried to treat them like Allstate agents. And a guy that used to be an independent doesn't like to be dictated to. And it was a huge mistake, and it took him a long time to recover from it. In the book Good to Great, there are a lot of stories of major companies where the new CEO came in and he didn't understand the culture of the business, and the companies almost failed. Many of the business owners that I've worked with and met have been dramatic individuals. I call them heroic leaders. Their hand is on every aspect of the business. They know how everything works. They know where everything is. They make every decision. And sometimes the business succeeds out of their sheer willpower. They don't delegate. They control. In a business that's built like that, usually is built on personal relationships. And the hardest person to replace is a relationship manager. So if a new owner comes in, he's got to build that relationship with the clients. He's got to build that relationship with the key employees. An attorney told me the story. He said there was a business that was started by an ex-military officer. And he said the guy ran the business with an iron fist. And he said there were many times on the manufacturing floor where disagreements were settled by his iron fist. Well, he sold the business to an individual that was more laid back, more collegial, more of a professor type. And after the new owner came in, the business began to fail. And so he called the old owner back and said, "Would you come tell me what I'm doing wrong?" And the old owner came back and he found out that absenteeism was up, that tardiness was up. They were taking too long at breaks. They were taking too long for lunch. And so what happened is the new owner lacked the ability to manage to the old culture, and he lacked the ability to change the culture. So what he had to do was to hire back the previous owner at an inflated salary plus the notes he was already paying him, just to keep his investment. We could spend all day on this one, all day today and all day tomorrow, on family feuds. They dominate the news, they dominate the talk shows, they dominate the gossip rags, and I've collected articles from all over the country about family feuds. I was actually in Finland one time, and there was a big family farm, and the leader of the family got to live in the big house, and I said, "How do you determine that?" And she said, "It's a really rugged deal because the family begins to fight and squabble." I remember having an article from Ketchikan, Alaska, which at that time was about 30,000 people, and it was a dispute that reverberated throughout the entire state. And it was a father and daughter that had come to such a disagreement and such acrimony that both of them had restraining orders on each other. But there are all sorts of these. When I prepared this presentation some time ago, if you go on Google, there were something like 356 family feuds. This put in business family feuds. On Bing, there were over 2 million. Summer Redstone and his son, Rupert Murdoch, Legal Seafood, two brothers, the Jackson family. Boy, when Michael Jackson died, the whole family began to fight over his money. And just recently, the court took the kids away from Michael's mother because she was mishandling things. Family feuds are awful. Crippling disagreements between shareholders. I have two clients. They're business partners. And they have a very successful business. And over time, it's grown to now they're taking out salaries of $2 million apiece. But unfortunately, as the business prospered, their relationship did not prosper. And so one of the partners said, "It's time to go. It's time to leave. I think the business has run its course. I think sooner or later another major player will come in and take all of our market share. We need to get out now." The other partner said, "No, I don't think we've run our course. I think we have a lot of growth left. I think we've got our market share as well protected. And besides that, I'm not ready to leave, and I'm too old to start another business." Well, unfortunately, the person that wanted out today wanted the business valued as a strategic buyer, someone who would buy the business based on the opportunity, the intellectual capitals, and their distribution system. In other words, they wanted it valued at people that bought it top price. The other owner is not going to buy him out at top price. He wants to apply all the discounts and buy it at the end. It was so bad, I brought in a team to do an ESOP. And the ESOP came in and they said, we'll 100% finance an ESOP plan at $120 million. And they couldn't agree on the price, and so the whole thing fell apart. This is always one of my favorites, incompetent nepotism. I want you to meet my son, Edward. One day this company will belong to him, and I think it's time all of you get to know each other better. One of the most difficult decisions is picking the child that's going to be the successor. And sometimes that's not who you think it's going to be. If you look at succession planning today, usually the daughter is the most capable of running the business. She's the one most likely to have successful outside experience somewhere else. But you try to make that decision, and sometimes that person's not ready, or that person's not capable, or that person's not willing. We worked with an individual that was a boat builder, and he started his boat factory in his garage. And he had a key employee that came along with him, and they had this unique concept for boats. And the business prospered and grew and grew and grew, and now it was making lots of money. And the dad was a very young 60, very good shape, and he liked to do a lot of things. He liked to travel. He liked to fish. He liked to go to his mountain cabin. And so what he wanted to do was to give the business to his son, but he wanted his key person to run it. And so when we got everybody together and the son came in, we suggested maybe that the son, to prepare him for ultimate management of the business, that he take over a division and run that and get his feet wet and then come on and learn another one. And it would have been a good transition period. There was another problem with the son, is he had a substance abuse problem, a really bad substance abuse problem. And the parents knew it, but they would not recognize it and they would not address it. The dad was making $1 million a year. And the son said, it's time for dad to go. I said, you mean ease out? No, it's time for him to leave the company, completely get out. It's time for me to earn the big bucks. It's time for me to have that $1 million salary. And so what happened is dad wasn't ready to leave and the son wasn't ready to lead. And the whole thing fell apart just because they couldn't come to grips with that. Not prepared for the wealth. I learned this question from an M&A, merger and acquisition individual. What are you going to do when you win the lottery? Think about that. I've got a client who's negotiating the sale of his business for $100 million. That's the equivalent of multiplying his unrealized net worth by 15. He's got 3 children and 5 grandchildren. 2 of the children are well established, 1's not. 1's got some problems. So what's dad going to do now with $100 million? Aside from the estate tax and the income tax and some other issues, do you see anything else that's coming along here? What's going to happen while all of that money pours in and the kids now begin to want their share? And when you picture it, I grew up in Texas, and you would go out to West Texas, and I'm sure that's similar a lot to Utah, and you would see this dry, barren desert, and there would be a sign there that'd say, watch for flash floods. And all you would see would be a dry creek bed and nothing there. But when the rains would come, they may rain 100 miles away from where you are, but all of a sudden it begins to build and those flash floods come through and they rip everything out that's in front of them. That's the same thing that happens with sudden wealth. You get what's called affluenza. Affluenza is a diagnosed psychological disease, which is a dysfunctional relationship with money or the pursuit of it. There's a lot of great books. The Golden Ghetto is one by Jesse O'Neill, where she was an heiress and what happened to her and why it was so bad. But a sudden influx of money can create a lot of problems. The person that gets it can have disbelief, elation, bewilderment, and the outcome's not always positive. Have you ever seen the articles about what happens to lottery winners and how long they actually keep the money? And in most cases, they lose all the money, end up in divorce, get murdered, get into bankruptcy, all sorts of problems because they're not prepared for the wealth when it comes. And they have a lot of questions and concerns. Will the money change who I am? Will it change how I believe? Do I trust myself to remain true to my values, or will I become a person that I detest? How will my relations change? How will I feel towards my friends? How will my friends feel towards me? So they have to deal with all the psychological impacts as well as the intense emotional response is not determined just by the wealth. I talked about my friend that had $100 million. I've seen it happen with a whole lot less money than that. My CPA told me a story of his two of his clients. And they had a very successful business that they sold for a lot of money. The one advisor, the one partner, went back to his old advisor and just invested the money without any study, forethought, or anything else. And when the economic downturn came, he lost most all of his money. And so he lost all of the fruits of his labor. Norm, on the other hand, took time to do due diligence. He interviewed a lot of advisors. And finally, he came up with somebody that understood what he wanted and what his risk tolerance was. And he put together an asset allocation plan that allowed him to ride out those situations. So I'm in an age now, and my clients are in an age, they're going to start selling businesses. This is a great time of life and a lot of opportunity. But when you come into that, you've got to be thinking about what the client wants, not about how much commission you're going to make on all of this money he's got. On a side note, what do you think your chances are of retaining a client? Russ Allen Prince conducted a survey of high net worth clients, and he found that 81% said that they plan to leave their current advisor. 86% felt that they were planning to tell their friends to avoid their current advisor. And only 2% were going to recommend their advisor. Now here's something else for you. If you know 8 of the 8 core values of your client, you'll get 100% of the business and you'll average 4.1 referrals of like people. If you know 5 of the 8, you'll get 72% of the business and you'll get 1.7 referrals. If you know 2 of the 8, you'll get 50% of the business and no referrals. So the question I always get is, how do you find out what their core values are? Is you ask them. But most people cannot articulate their core values. If I ask you what your core values were, you'd probably say honesty, ethics, hard work, faith, family. But those may not really be what your core values are. So it's how you ask that. Now, one of the ways that you get that information is I could sit down with any one of you out here having a Coke, and in 5 minutes I would know what your 8 core values are. And you would never feel that you disclosed anything to me out of the ordinary. You would think that we had a really great conversation. So here's the question. Ask this of your clients when you're having lunch or a cup of coffee or something like that. When you were growing up, was there an individual that had a major impact on your life? Could be in your formative years when you were college, whatever. Is there a person that had a major impact on your life? I hope you're thinking of that person. What was it about that person that impacted you? What did you see in that person that you thought was really important? And what you saw and what you learned from them, how has that impacted your life today? And if it was that impactful to you, have you told your children? And if they're still alive, have you thanked them? Here's the deal. The core value, what they see in that other person are their own core values, because you can't recognize those values unless you have them in your own life. It's a great conversation to have. And your client will come away thinking that you're really a great person to do business with. Well, there's all sorts of other landmines that we could talk about, but this gives you a perspective on some of them that are there. The problem with handling landmines is in many cases they're not discussed. They go undisclosed, and then all of a sudden they blow up, and by the time you find out they're there, you can't do anything about them, or you have very limited options of what you do about them. The one thing that we can do, though, is we can help them start building wealth outside the business. So the questions that we would ask to try to discover some of these landmines are you building wealth outside the business? How can we do that? Well, we could use cash value life insurance. We could use a 162 bonus. We could use retirement plans. We could use other non-qualified assets. Are you managing your business to prepare for the transition? Are you the indispensable person in your company? Then you have the value of the key person, the value of life insurance, disability. What does retirement building, what does retirement mean to you? Are you managing your business to prepare for the transition? Have you covered all your bases? Now, here's the one question nobody's asking. If you go back and you ask these to your clients, nobody is asking this. When was the first time all of your advisors got together to understand what your role is for yourself and what you want now and in the future? When was the first time your advisors worked in a collaborative team to create a structure to get what your it is, to get it done? And the answer to that question, unfortunately, is never. So thank you very much. Any questions? We have the handout up here.